Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hey, 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 and welcome to the Feminist Book Club podcast, the show that brings you the best of the best feminist content. I'm your host, Neba from Notes by Neba, and happy October! It is spooky season. Today, I thought we would kind of go along with that theme. We're getting into something that I'm really excited about. It is books that fit the dark academia aesthetic. I think dark academia just, like, it's just been this aesthetic that's really risen during the plague, really. A lot of people have turned to it to kind of, like, romanticize their study life, their work life. Let's get into what it is. For those of you guys who don't know, dark academia is basically this aesthetic that romanticizes classic literature with this, like, passion for knowledge and learning. It's very, very rooted in European culture. It's a lot of, like, nostalgia for the 19th and early 20th century private schools in England. And a lot of the followers of dark academia are drawn to Greek architecture, ancient arts, mythology. Think, like, you know, reading books while sipping tea in the depths of a library with, like, not a ton of light, but maybe some candlelight. It is very a little bit Eurocentric, but I have noticed a lot of really amazing people of color and other people, like non-Europeans, really taking this aesthetic and making it their own. So I think that's really beautiful and really awesome. And, you know, aesthetics don't belong to a specific group of people. So I love seeing that all over the media now. So as people turned to dark academia during, you know, the whole plague, it kind of, like, you know, it really started getting huge after schools were physically shut down and colleges were shut down. And so a lot of students were working from home, studying from home, taking tests from home. And I think this was just a really awesome, like, imaginary outlet. And, you know, Harry Potter got really, really huge randomly on TikTok last year. And so a lot of TikTokers, were exploring, you know, like, childhood Hogwarts fantasies. I personally am not a huge Harry Potter fan anymore after J.K. Rowling came out as just being, like, a TERF and not very inclusive or woke and about Harry Potter. But it is a very great example of a place that would be great for the dark academia aesthetic. So without further ado, let's get into some of these books that we have. First up is A Little Life by, I'm going to do my best with the name, Hanya Yanagihara. She is like a female Asian author, and I love that she is using this book to kind of, like, bring awareness to normal human emotions and just how to cope with them. In society, there's this kind of idea of success equals happiness, which may not always be true. And so the sadness, death, and academia kind of concept fits this aesthetic perfectly. Her book, A Little Life, it's about four young men in the same college who all move to New York for big careers. It's mostly on Jude, who is kind of this, like, broken, full of secrets man. I'll add some trigger warnings. He also self-harms, slices his calves and arms at, like, 2 a.m. His body has tons of scars all over it. I think this book is just a really great chronicle of this age of anxiety that we're currently in. There's a lot of drama, but there's also, you know, friendship and drugs and travel and love affairs and interior design, which personally I really love having nice descriptions of interiors. It's hard to hit that balance between, like, descriptive enough to be painting the picture, but without getting so descriptive that you just get bored. And one thing that's really great about this book is there is no, like, commonly held beliefs that kind of, like, bind everyone together. There's this, like, gap between dreams and reality. And it kind of centers around this concept of, like, this big life that they're chasing in New York, these big careers, those big lives are that you wanted. It's just the little life that you made. So if anxiety is the problem that we're kind of, like, struggling with in this age, then friendship might be a little bit of the cure. So there's a couple trigger warnings throughout this whole book. Self-harm, like I mentioned, sexual abuse, binges, psychological manipulation, kidnapping, imprisonment. There's a violent accident, a couple moments of prejudice against people living with disabilities, drug users, addiction. You'll notice that like a lot of the Dark Academia books do have a lot of trigger warnings, but it goes with the aesthetic. And I think, you know, you can't, if any of this is triggering to you, do not, you know, read these books. But it is a really great way to kind of like look at these struggles and issues from a different lens. So next up, we have Legend Born by Tracy Dion. It's basically about kind of this 16-year-old named Bree Matthews. And after her mom dies in an accident, she wants absolutely nothing to do with her family memories or childhood home. So this program for bright high schoolers at UNC Chapel Hill is the perfect escape until she sees a magical attack on her very first night on campus. So she thinks that there's more to her mom's death than what's on the police report. So she goes through this whole mystery of trying to figure out the truth, even if that means infiltrating the Legendborn as one of their initiates. She has to decide how far she'll go for the truth and whether she will use magic to take the society down or to join the fight. This is a really interesting book for me because it's kind of based a little bit around this program that I used to live two blocks from this high school, where in North Carolina, they will have all high schoolers in the entire state take this test. And if they like, you know, rank high enough, they can go live on campus in this school. It's a public school with incredible access to all kinds of STEM things. Like they have a robotics program, tons of funding, awesome visuals. It is basically like an on-campus two-year program for bright students. The school in real life is actually located in Durham, North Carolina. But I really like that it kind of like, you know, Brit took this concept that does exist. One of the things I always struggled with Hogwarts was like, oh, would a kid really be this okay with living away from their parents at 10 years old? That seems weird. Or 11 years old. That seems weird. And, you know, maybe some children are, but a lot of them aren't. So 16 always felt a little bit better. Throughout this book, there are a lot of issues of racial prejudice, representation. There's a lot of concept around needing to like work harder to prove your worth because you are female or a person of color. And I related to that super strongly, but I loved that there was a lot of like POC and queer representation. There's non-binary characters. Her best friend is Asian. And with this mix of, you know, death and mystery and magic and high school and college, it's just like the perfect Dark Academia read. Trigger warnings would be, I guess, slavery, trauma, violence, alcohol consumption, sexual abuse. Or sorry, not sexual abuse, that's for the previous one. Car accidents, there's physical abuse, there is rape. All of this is kind of awful and terrible, but the rape is on page, it's not graphic. And overall, I just think it was a really, really awesome book. This one was amazing. Next up, we have The Impossible Girl by Lydia King. This is about Cora Lee, who has been born out of wedlock. She's the daughter of this wealthy socialite and an Asian immigrant, and it's all set in 1850 New York. But she is also the only female resurrectionist, and she's very good at that. But she's also hiding a secret, which is that a lot of people who practice anatomy for, you know, studying bodies, those people will pay her huge sums of money for bodies that have strange anomalies. Perhaps these people would also pay a fortune to get their hands on her body, because she is a girl born with two hearts, which is a legend among grave robbers, and she'll be in mortal danger if her secret ever comes out. I love that she is kind of going through this environment and time that's not kind to women. She's a very strong female character. Throughout, you know, the Dark Academia aesthetic, it's usually set in like a time that's not exactly amicable to women. So this book kind of was a nice little twist on looking at what that would be like. But I love that she was like a successful half-Asian woman. She's working with her circumstances. Even though she's born out of wedlock, she still is kind of like making the most of what she can. And with, you know, the death, the mystery, the New York City setting, there's just a lot of Dark Academia vibes, a very gothic atmosphere, a lot of medical references, which I thought was really cool. Trigger warnings for this book include attempted rape, grave robbing, murder, and sexual assault. Next up, we have Stalking Jack the Ripper by, I'll do my best with this name again, Carrie Manislasco. So it's about 17-year-old Audrey Rose Wadsworth. She is born a lord's daughter. She has a life of wealth and privilege. But between all of this, like, you know, fancy tea gatherings and fancy dress fittings, she has this secret life where she slips away to her uncle's lab to study the gruesome practice of forensic medicine. So she is working on a string of murders that have been killed in a very odd, savage way. And so she starts investigating the serial murderer. But her search for these answers is very surprising. It brings her close to her own real world, her day job, so to speak. Once again, we have an amazing, strong female character who doesn't want women to be thought of as weak, but she also wants women to think for themselves, and she's studying for this, like, man's job. Even though she's kind of, like, you know, hiding this study, it's still kind of a really good portrayal of how women, you know, had to pursue these things. In real life, there's a lot of cases of women pretending to be men to have these jobs. There's famous cases of women who pretended to be doctors and things like that, just to kind of, like, you know, because back then it used to be a field that was like that. And so with this main character studying forensic science while she's mingling with the upper class society, I think this really just fits the core of dark academia. Trigger warnings. We have a lot of dead bodies. This is with graphic descriptions, so I'll warn you about that pretty hard. There's some drug abuse, imprisonment, murder, toxic parenting, trauma in general. And that one, it just, I think really with all of these books with dark academia, it's hard to kind of escape some of the darker side, so to speak, which is, I apologize because, you know, if anyone out there wants a book without trigger warnings, let us know and I can find one for you. And then last, but certainly not least, because I raved about this book for, like, so long, that we have Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo. She, oh my god, I made a whole episode about this. Highly, 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 highly recommend this book. It was so freaking good. If you don't want to listen to that whole episode, I'll give you a little spiel. It's about this girl named Alex Stern, and she had to drop out of school because she kind of has this ability to see dead people, sort of. Dead people, ghosts, unclear. It's explained as time goes on. So she has a special ability, and so she drops out of school because she can't handle the trauma of all of this. And so instead she goes into this world of drug dealer boyfriends and dead-end jobs. And by age 20, she is the sole survivor of a horrific unsolved multiple homicide. But while she's, like, laying in her hospital bed trying to get better, this person offers to let her attend Yale. And she is like, why me? And turns out Yale has these secret societies. Ka-ta-ta. I think the societies of Yale have been this, like, topic of conversation forever, but I just love the concept of secret societies in college. It's so dark academia, like, literally the aesthetic 101. So she has to work for one of these secret societies, and her job is kind of like a manager of the other secret societies in a weird way. She has to, like, make sure that the other societies are kept in check, they're not doing anything too intense, that their occult activities are staying within the bounds that they've all agreed on. But within the very first night, she stumbles upon a murder, basically. And so these occult activities are revealed to be a lot more sinister and more extraordinary. And along the way, we learn a lot about Alex herself. And I loved that she was a woman of color protagonist. It comes up a fair amount. She has Asian friends. There's a lot of queer representation. It's a very real, believable female character. I like that she towed the line between, you know, she explains her past and it kind of explains why she acts the way she does, which it's very much through Show Not Tell. All the books by Leigh Bardugo are pretty amazing, although against popular opinion, I actually do not like her series of Shadow and Bone. I think the main character is awful and not at all a good, realistic female. But that's beside the point. So for Ninth House, I would say trigger warnings are probably the violence, rape and sexual assault, murder, gore, drug addiction, overdosing, death and suicide and blackmail and self-harm, and forced consumption of human waste, which was, it's done very artistically. It's done very well. So those are the books that fit the dark academia aesthetic. As always, all of these links will be in the description below. If you have anything you would like me to talk about, feel free to slide into my DMs. They're always open. You can find me on YouTube and Insta and Twitter and TikTok at Notes by Neba. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I hope you have a spooky and happy Halloween.
Greetings, friends. Mariquita Guerrera here, and I'm only just now catching my breath after reading Miriam Tave's gorgeous new book, Fight Night, published October 5th by Bloomsbury. Fight Night is a long letter, written or imagined, by 9-year-old Swift to her absent father, in which she narrates at a breakneck pace her inner monologue and the day-to-day goings-on of her life with her mother and grandmother. The book opens with Swiv having recently been suspended from school for having won too many fights, circumstances which would not have occurred, she believes, if only she had known the correct number of fights she was allowed to have, and progresses almost in a series of vignettes connected only by virtue of the people at the center of them. Grandma Elvira is the real fixed point of this story, around which everything else turns. Constantly making allusions to her wild past, an unimaginable life fully lived, her wry anecdotes and asides clearly being the model for Swiv's own perspective. Swiv's exhausted and pregnant mother, who, if she has a name, I honestly do not recall it, and I did look for it, and I couldn't find it. She functions almost as the straight man to the constant comic chaos of Swiv and her grandma. The story reaches a crescendo when Grandma Elvira, visiting nephews in California with Swiv, seriously injures herself while dancing like a fool. A tragedy you can see coming slowly on, but you cannot avoid. Earlier in the book, Elvira mentions that a fall for people her age can only mean the end of them, a comment that functions like Chekhov's gun. And the reader despairs at the veracity of it when it comes to fruition. Strong, vibrant matriarchs are hard enough to come by in literature. Even more so when they are dynamic, hilarious, kind, and the loss of one feels devastating. In the hands of any other writer, though, this would mark a turning point in the book, a descent into sadness, but not for Taves. In fact, there are ample opportunities in Fight Night for the tone to turn solemn, despondent. There is discussion of suicide, of severe depression, of substance abuse, of displacement. But that isn't the lens used here. It is a masterclass in confronting the darker corners of reality with acceptance and a view toward the future and toward expectation of joy. This, in fact, is the thesis of the book. There's this gorgeous passage where Elvira is talking to Swiv about her mother, about a painful point in her mother's life, and about how to conceptualize pain in life in general. She says, "They took something from us. They took it from us. They stole it from us. It was our tragedy, which is our humanity. We need those things. We need tragedy, which is the need to love and the need, not just the need, the imperative, the human imperative to experience joy, to find joy and to create joy all through the night, the fight night." Isn't that beautiful? Imagine perceiving tragedy as the human imperative to experience joy. This isn't underpinned with toxic positivity. It's girded by strength and resilience and adaptability. It is held together by community. There are so many achingly lovely moments in this book. Tiny details which capture the reader and bring them fully into this unique world. Swiv holding her hand against her grandma's stomach to feel it rise and fall as she breathes. The doorbell playing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" every time someone rings it. Swiv's sudden embarrassing revelation that fever is an inappropriate ringtone for her to use for her mother. despite having chosen it because her mom likes to hold her tight and kiss her, and also often gives her colds. There is no coming of age in this story. This is the period of time before the building's Roman, but it is no less transformative or engaging for it. In fact, it is strengthened by the intersection of immaturity and headstrong sense of self possessed by Swift. I'm afraid I'm not doing justice to this book. I have spent the last few days sort of processing how I feel about it, and it slowly dawned on me that I am in love. It's not for everyone. I know there are people who would feel put off by the incredulous precocity of the main character, by the choppy sentence structure, by the careening from one subject to the next. It may be too quirky for some, too precious, too effete. I recognize that. But things can be so caustic, you know, at times. They can be too pessimistic. And this feels like an antidote to that, if you need an antidote to that, and I do. The time spent in this world was time spent exploring identity and anxiety and anger within the safe confines of loving and supportive women. And I suppose I need to see more of that. So, for me, Fight Night was refreshing. Not saccharine, not prescriptive. Just dry sarcasm and dry wit and confidence that it will be okay. The good and the bad, all okay. I think you should check it out. If you agree, you can find the link to Fight Night by Miriam Taves in our show notes. Let me know what you think if you read it. I'd love to hear. I'm Mariquita Guerrera, and you can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray. That's OH_MURRAY. Thanks for spending this time with me. Until next time, friends, be well.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a thing.